How do high-performing teams believe and behave differently? And what can the area of sports performance psychology teach us about agility? That's this week on the Badass Agile Podcast. Greetings, team. Welcome to the Badass Agile Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Williams. Greetings, team, and welcome back to another episode of the Badass Agile Podcast. Listen, guys, we can get good at Agile all we want, but at the end of the day, when you get into the team room, if the performance isn't there, the motivation isn't there, nothing's going to change. So I'm fascinated with those areas of human performance that make people better and that make teams stronger. What better place to look for examples of the best than in sports and sports psychology? So I'm honored today to have a guest with me, Matt Command from Consistent Elite Performance, who's going to tell us a little bit about what he does and what he's learned in the field from coaching elite teams. Matt, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for dropping by the studio, brother. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell the Badass Agile family a bit about yourself?
Sure. So my background is in sports psychology. So over the last few years, I've been working with primarily youth athletes, elite youth athletes, kind of ages 8 to 20, on developing mental skills. So things like visualization and imagery, things like consistent confidence, decreasing any performance anxiety they may have. Emotional regulation and composure is a really big one. Focus and concentration is a really big one. And then also I've been working with coaches and parents on developing an environment where their athletes can be at their best consistently. So trying to remove any psychological barriers, emotional barriers. And then recently moving more towards corporate coaching and taking the principles of human performance, the principles of sports psychology, and applying them to high-performing individuals and high-performing teams in corporate settings.
So, I mean, it starts with eight-year-olds, but it also includes the parents.
Absolutely.
So why is that? Why do we feel like we should include the little kids, and why do we feel like we should get the parents involved too?
So really good question. I think the kids themselves, whether they're 8 or 15 or 18 or 20, they're the ones going through the experience. They're the ones with different challenges facing either, you know, teammates they might not get along with, conflict, role changing, things like that, as well as things outside of sport that are impacting their sport. The parents are obviously extremely involved, some more than others, but the feedback they give, the frequency, the type of feedback, the environment around or the idea around adversity, I think comes a lot from the parents and how to deal with adversity. And is it somebody else's fault, or is it, you know, how do you just frame things in a way that is geared more towards growth rather than towards achievement? So really trying to help parents reframe that and best support their athletic child.
So that's awesome. Now, full disclosure, you came and visited my client just earlier this week.
I did.
And did the same presentation effectively that you do for some of your sports teams and your parents. And I don't know if you felt it in the room, but they were blown away.
I hope so.
They totally were, because the stuff that you were bringing is not stuff that we talk about openly, because I think corporate culture doesn't have the same kind of demand. There's no trophy necessarily, or at least we don't think there is, right? In business, yeah. The trophy is really, it's going to be sales, it's going to be your KPIs, but there's no big shining golden thing every 8 months, and we don't feel that rush to the finish line. So what I'm interested in, from an Agile perspective, team is everything. The way I say it is like this, and in Agile, if you've ever seen the movie Apollo 13, you got a bunch of committed, loyal people who've got a problem to solve. And if they don't solve it, the consequences are big and present, and they're notable. So people behave in ways that are conducive to getting the job done. So automatically, hierarchies drop. Teams are self-empowering. Trust goes through the roof. All of the things that we want to have happen, happen organically because of the seriousness of the problem. But the difficulty we have in the corporate environment is scaling that performance. So what I'm interested in hearing from you is, what are the things that block teams from performing? Let's start there.
So I think on an individual basis, ego is probably the best word, or the lack of humility. Or, you know, when people first join a team, or even if they've been there for years, they want to demonstrate competence. They want to feel valued. And if the environment isn't geared towards that explicitly, then they're going to try to do that in other ways. And maybe that's stepping on other people's toes. Maybe that's not listening as well. Maybe that's just not being a great teammate or a team member.
Okay. And then what are some things that we should be doing? Like there's a whole can of worms in there. You brought up culture, you brought up environment. So in order to clear those blockers and get teams performing at their best, what are some things that we have to do?
I think the first thing is people need to understand and people need to be connected to why they're doing what they're doing. And the value they bring to the team needs to be explicitly communicated to them pretty consistently. So I think a lot of employees might be thinking, well, why am I even doing this? Or I work hard, I'm not recognized. Wanting to be recognized is not a selfish thing. It's a human thing. So if that need is not met consistently, then motivation drops, engagement drops, willing to take risks drops. So there's a lot of negative outcomes that come from that need not being met. So that to me is probably the biggest issue with poor teams is that people aren't really connected as to why we're doing what we're doing. Is what I'm doing going to really help you out?
Right.
If that's not made clear, then that's a problem.
So in your experience, let's give the listener something tactical they can
sure.
use. How do you find your, do we call this finding your why? That's what I call it.
Yeah, you could. Absolutely. I think the word purpose comes up to play quite a bit. So it's discovering why you're doing what you're doing. And as soon as you find that answer, ask why again. And when you find that answer, ask why again and keep kind of peeling back the layers.
Okay.
And eventually you'll get to kind of your personal mission statement or why you're doing, why you've made sacrifices in other areas of your life to now work here or to contribute to this team. So I think discovering your why is absolutely essential and just trying to determine the deeper meaning as to why you're doing what you're doing. It's not going to the same room every day, the same office building every day to get a paycheck every other Friday. Trying to make a difference in somebody's life and trying to make a difference, whether that's your client, whether that's a mentee you may have at work, whoever it's going to be, something that you can feel connected to that's outside your own gains. I think that's where people find that engagement, that commitment, that motivation.
Right. So the way I always peel that onion is to say there's your picture of the world when you're done with it. So what have you done to improve or change, or what does that change look like? But then you have to root it in service. You have to get really specific about who you serve, how you're going to serve them, and why you want to serve that group. So it helps you narrow down. For example, let's say you want to help women. Let's say you want to help children who never got a chance, underprivileged, underserviced. Maybe you want to help artists. Maybe you want to help, hockey players. So you get a sense of who you want to serve, and then you have to figure out why those people. And I always find that usually once you narrow it down like that, you can see in yourself a reflection of the person that you ended up wanting to serve, which is so interesting. So are there questions you can ask yourself to get to that why, though? Is there a place like some... So if I say to a newcomer, go find your purpose, go figure out your why. Ask yourself why, then ask yourself why again, as you put it. But a lot of times when you ask somebody why, they just sit there.
Yeah.
So how do you get them out of there?
So the first thing is always personal reflection, always. So increasing self-awareness, what are your strengths? So that's a tough question for people. We don't often sit and look in the mirror or, stand up in the shower and think, what am I good at? Or how do I impact people in a positive way? But I think that's a really important conversation to have with yourself. So what are my strengths? And then how can I, as you mentioned, impact other groups while I'm using my strengths? And I think that's when people really find purpose. That's when people really find meaning is, I know what my strengths are. Mm-hmm. I'm in a position to use them, and not just to benefit myself, mm-hmm. but to benefit other people.
Now, let me ask you a question. That's at the individual level. Think for a second and give us your feedback or give us your ideas on how do we then congeal a group using the same method? Does a team have to ask themselves why?
Yes, I think absolutely it does, or they do. Again, a team, whether it's a sports team or a marketing team, you all have goals, whether they're short-term, long-term, it's to win the trophy or to gain more market share or to increase client acquisition, client retention, whatever your outcome long-term goals are. But motivation is impacted by long-term goals, but attention and engagement are not. So process goals, the meaning, that's what's going to impact kind of day-to-day performance. Winning the trophy in 8 months or having this big pitch in 4 months or even 1 month away. Yes, it's what everybody talks about. It's what we all want to accomplish, But day to day, we're not going to be at our best, nor will we be connected to each other, feel connected to each other, mm-hmm. if we're not focused on the present moment, if we're not focused on the process right now. What can we do right now in the next hour that's going to bring us together or help us achieve our goal?
Okay. Now, you brought up something interesting there, which is connection to each other. And in corporate environments, we're not trained and we're not rewarded or encouraged for opening up to one another and sharing the things that we value and our dreams and goals, right? So how do we, you know, put eight people in a room? How would you get people connecting with one another?
If I were the leader?
Yeah.
Do it first.
Nice.
Use your own personal example.
Nice.
So I always like to think that a leader's best teaching tool is their own personal example. So if you're not willing to demonstrate humility, if you're not willing to say, I screwed up, if you're not willing to express gratitude, you can't expect your team to.
Right.
So that's what I would do first. And then I would create an environment that begets vulnerability or that kind of increases that risk taking. Because people are only going to take risks if they feel the safety net a little bit underneath.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you create that environment is, again, being open yourself, talking about how risk-taking will increase growth. It may not, you might not achieve what you want all the time because obviously inherent in risk is the chance of failure.
Right.
And that's what risk is. But you're not going to get any better if you don't take risks.
Right.
So having this discussion around risk, around innovation, around taking chances, around mistakes, around failures, around adversity, and framing it in a way that these are all extremely, not only are they positive, they're absolutely necessary,
right,
for us to grow bigger and better, but also more together.
Now, we can talk about, like, I could put you in a room in front of people, my clients, for example, and we could have that discussion and say, it's important to take risks. It's important to tame fear. It's important to experiment. But at the end of the day, if the culture doesn't support that, you're going to feel it. So the way that's going to show up is you're going to tell people to go innovate. They're going to go innovate and you're going to say, great, great idea. What's next? Then they're going to say, let's go ask the boss. Let's go ask the boss's boss. Let's fill out the paperwork. Let's do all the things that we've always done. So what would you do to change the culture? Because let's face it, we can do everything we want in the team room. If the larger culture doesn't change at an organizational level, then they might leap for a little while, but pretty soon they're going to get the smackdown and they're going to go back to their old ways of thinking. So I think that the cultural change at large is super critical. How do you have that conversation with leaders who are not accustomed to behaving? They're not measured that way. They're not compensated that way. What would you do?
So I would say the first thing is letting go of control. You cannot control, even if you're the CEO or the team lead, you cannot control what everything that's going on. You've hired people presumably because you trust them to do their job. So if things are going poorly or if there's a mistake that happened, A, you diagnose that mistake unemotionally,
right,
and you prescribe a set of actions or decisions moving forward. B, you have open-ended discussion about it and say, okay, this didn't go the way we wanted to. What can we do differently next time? The answer is probably not, I'm going to supervise you. Because supervision just saps motivation all the time. If someone's watching over your shoulder, having to check all the work that you do, you're not going to feel empowered. You're not going to feel engaged.
Right.
So that would be the biggest thing, is letting go of that control. Again, yourself with your own personal example. That would be my number one answer.
Okay. So thank you for that. That's awesome. So here's where I'd like to go next. I'm fascinated by the science of flow. What gets 8 people, 10 people, 12 people doing everything right? Right? Because in hockey, where you live, and baseball, where you live, when a team is flowing, it's magic, right? It's like an experience and people want to be part of that. I love the idea, you know, and your inherent in your company name is the word elite. So I love the idea of teams that just have something special that other teams don't have. And to my mind, flow is part of that secret sauce. So how does flow work in your opinion? How do you get it going? What does it look like? What does it require?
So I think the number one thing is a present focus. So in sports, absolutely in sports, but in business as well, people are very concerned with the outcome, very concerned with the results. Again, we all know what we want to do. We want to win the championship. We want to make the playoffs. We want to get more clients, whatever the outcome goal is. We all know that. But in the moment, if that's what we're actively putting our attention on, we will not be at our best. So having a present focus and really understanding what's going on with you internally. Where's my attention? Where's my breath? Where's my muscular tension, all that kind of stuff, having some self-awareness in the moment, and what's going on externally. So, you know, what information do I need to pay attention to right now for me to be at my best, and process that information and then make decisions. In terms of group flow, I think we can kind of start anticipating what everyone's going to do, and we kind of stack on each other. And that's how innovation works. And that's how, you know, elite teams, athletic teams work, where, you know, the word chemistry comes up, you know what your teammate's going to do before they do it, type of thing, right?
So right.
That to me takes probably weeks and months of practice and work and togetherness and vulnerability and trust. And then you get to this point where, you know, you're experiencing flow and you really are very indifferent to the outcome, which is really counterintuitive to everything we learn,
right?
Long-term goals are motivating and all that. You're really indifferent to the outcome in the moment. Once the game, before the game and after the game, obviously you care about achieving your goals. In the moment, there are much more important things you need to directly, deliberately put your attention on to have a good game. And let's pick a sport like soccer. Probably where you are in the field is a cue you need to know. Where your teammates are, where the opponents are, where the ball is. These are all cues, what play you're running as, you know, what coach, what your system is, what your position is, the roles and responsibility of your position. Those are all cues that you need to deliberately access to make good decisions on the court, on the field. So if you're running around thinking, I want to win, I want to win, I want to win, you're going to miss all those cues. So that to me is the biggest thing, is being totally engaged in what's going on. And not worrying about what it might mean. Oh, we're down 2-0. We're going to lose the game. What if this? What if that? All my clients I work with, the number one thing I want to eliminate from their vocabulary all the time is the what ifs. So athletes often, and people in general often think, well, if this goes poorly, my world's going to be really impacted, where I won't get another opportunity. I might get cut. I might not get that client next time. I might not get the promotion. And humans are really good at catastrophizing. So chances are the perception of the outcome is wrong.
Right.
It's not going to be as bad as you think. The sun is going to come up tomorrow. So understanding that these are all steps in development and steps in growth, I think is the biggest thing too.
So you raised two really interesting topics there. The first one is rehearsal, because knowing your cues and knowing where you're supposed to be and focusing on the mechanics is something you have to train up on. And I always tell teams, expect the first 3-4 sprints, which is basically 8 weeks, to be mayhem. As you learn those cues, probably same thing happens to a stage actor in an ensemble, right? And so tell me a little bit more about training is question one, but I don't want to forget. The second thing is, it's fine to say, don't live in the past or live in the future while you're trying to be present. That's very true. But if we're only living in the present, we don't have a mechanism to find and fix our gaps potentially. So I'm interested in what we do in Agile is called retrospective, where we pause, but we pause frequently to inspect and adapt. Like even a boxer goes in and tries something and steps back immediately to see if it was working. And if it wasn't working, you have seconds to adjust. So two questions in there. Tell me about rehearsal and then tell me about inspecting and adapting.
Sure. So in sports, rehearsal is practice. So whatever the sport is, we teach kids how to run, we teach them how to jump, we teach them how to skate, we teach them how to shoot. We never teach them where to direct their attention. So that is the biggest gap, I think, from a mental conditioning perspective. And in formal schooling, we might teach you how to gain new clients. We might teach you marketing. We might teach you creative advertising. In school and in professional development, we rarely teach you where to direct your attention. So that to me is having an awareness first about where is my attention right now? And then having, I call them focus anchors or cues, to deliberately put your attention where it needs to be when it needs to be there. Because there's, like I said, there's information you need to process to make good decisions, mm-hmm. no matter what you're doing. And what's going to happen in 2 months or in 1 month or next week, if I don't get it done, is not an important cue for
right.
you to be at your best. It's just not. Now, going back to your reflection or retrospective question, absolutely critical. Absolutely critical. However, in a performance, you want to turn off your conscious brain. So your rehearsal and your training and your preparation has to be so good and so deliberate that when your performance comes, you're on autopilot. You're on autopilot. So you're not really evaluating yourself mid-performance. Your self-consciousness is totally turned off. And after the game or after your interview or after your pitch, that's when you take an unemotional diagnosis, an unemotional assessment, and say, okay, what did I do well? What did I not do well? How do I want to handle this little trigger next time better or differently?
Right.
So that personal reflection is critical, but I would say not in the moment.
Got it. Now, I know the listeners could use your advice on this. One of the big challenges we have in retrospectives is having meaningful conversations about gaps, because you don't want to hurt each other's feelings, and most of us don't want to stare down the big, black, ugly barrel of seeing ourselves as we really are. So how do you encourage that in teams?
Do it yourself first. I know I've said that before.
100%.
But do it yourself first. Second one, it would be, again, it's you want to remove any permanence of any evaluation, any assessment, any test, any interview, any pitch. So if you didn't get it done this time, I don't want to say that's okay, because sometimes it's not quite okay. However, another opportunity is going to come. And it might not be with us. Maybe it was so bad that the opportunities here aren't going to be there for you anymore. That happens. That's a possibility in life. But somewhere down the line in your life, an opportunity is coming. Let's look at the facts. You need to be better prepared. So having that future orientation to feedback and to meetings and to performance reviews or to retrospect, to look back and say, okay, what did I do well? What did I not do well? But not focus on the past, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Focus on how am I going to use that information and use that feedback to improve my future performances. And that's really, we hear the term mental toughness all the time. The simplest, most concise definition I love is taking feedback and use it to improve future performances. And it's to the point. And that's where a lot of people struggle, is they don't want to see that feedback. They don't want to hear it from the coach or from the boss. And you're going to get stuck where you are, which is an awful place to be.
Absolutely.
It's going to be comfortable because you're in your comfort zone and it's all good, but you're not going to get any better. And eventually you'll get to a place where you're going to have a hard time contributing.
Right. Here's something, I know you'll resonate with this one, but it's the idea of a fixed mindset. So often in what I do, we encounter people who are like, so the number one thing I hear is, this is all great. This sounds wonderful. Would love to innovate. Would love to go faster. Would love to have happier, self-enabled, self-empowered teams. But you don't understand those four words. You don't get it. Things are different here. Everyone tells me that they're unique because they're highly regulated. They're being monitored. They're a public company. Failure's not an option. So everyone tells me that it can't be done. You must hear that all the time. You must run into athletes who are like, I can't do this.
Well, I run into athletes who say that, but I probably run into more coaches who say that about their athletes, which is very frustrating. But
yeah,
they make this permanent assessment that this kid can't penalty kill, or she can't be the point guard, she can't play point guard. And because you didn't do it once or twice, coaches make this permanent assessment that you don't have what it takes. And I think it's up to coaches and bosses and managers and leaders to identify those gaps and develop an individual or create an individual development plan for that particular employee. We do that in sports. Here's your off-season development plan, or here's your in-season development plan. Why don't we do that in finance or in law or in marketing, where you take a weakness or an area of growth and not only view it, but you run towards it, because really that your areas for growth are your highest leveraged area for change.
Now explain that. What do you mean by highest leveraged area for change?
So let's say your public speaking is really weak, but you have to be in front of people all the time, and that's really holding you back from being at your best. Imagine what you would be if you changed that.
Right.
So we can all work on our strengths, and we can all work on and using our strengths effectively, but again, identifying those areas for growth, you're filling that gap in and having really deliberate practice and training and confronting it. And it's going to be uncomfortable and it's going to be tough. And it's not inherently fun. It's not fun. But it's absolutely necessary if you want to be elite, if you want to be, at the top of the food chain kind of, and continuously grow. You're going to have to identify weaknesses and work on them deliberately. Do so quickly.
You know, Matt, what you do is so important, because as companies are looking to compete in areas where they're not used to competing, They're looking for an edge. And what they think their edge is going to be is like specialization, modernization, trimming the bottom line, cutting expenses, finding ways to increase revenue. That's all wonderful. But if you can't deliver on customer demand effectively, you can't compete, period. And I don't think companies yet are aware of how what you do is an investment. Like, notice everything you've spoken about is as applicable to soccer as it is to marketing. You're really not talking about marketing technique here. You don't need to go to Harvard to get a marketing degree to perform at an elite level.
No. And that's the thing where these principles, you know, the mental skills, confidence, anxiety, breathing, mindfulness, visualization, concentration, they're like the term life skills, but they're skills that everybody can and should be using. And they're also skills that prevent people from being at their best consistently. So negative self-talk, you know, inability to focus effectively or consistently, those are things that really impact poor performances. So, and create barriers for people. So yeah, like you said, if you're doing marketing or playing soccer, it's extremely applicable. I know in my teaching and in my coaching, like I do mindfulness, you know, I do breathing. I have a pre-game routine every time. And I know for me to be at my best, either in front of the class or behind the bench, I need to be at a certain level of intensity. I need to understand what's going to dictate my behavior today. Right, is a question I like to ask myself a lot. Is it going to be a ref who makes a bad call? Is it going to be a player who plays poorly or doesn't work hard in practice? Because I have had those things dictate my behavior. And then again, later on in the retrospective, you're like, wow, I really didn't treat that player the way I wanted to. Or I didn't handle that adversity the way I wanted to. I wasn't the coach I wanted to be.
Right.
So you have to have that self-awareness and that those reflection skills of what's going to dictate my behavior today. And I hope the answer is always, you know, my coaching philosophy, my teaching philosophy, my personal values, and having that alignment. But things happen where your emotions get out of whack and suddenly you're behaving in a way that you don't love. And I think that's when people find a lot of stress.
Okay. So let's get tactical for a couple of minutes. I love the stuff that you're talking about, because when I talk about journaling, meditation, yoga, mindfulness, sacred silence, those things, people's eyes glaze over. Because they don't want to hear someone with badass on his business card say things like that. But the truth be told, special operations teams all visualize, all meditate. They all have a serious culture around intuition. Likewise, LeBron James, I think I either read it or heard it said that if you watch him courtside before a game, his eyes are closed. He's someplace else. Like, this is something that he uses. And countless athletes fall into that category as well. But let's get tactical. Let's give the team something they can really use. So in Agile, we have something called the demo, which is at the end of a two-week cycle, you're going to go in front of everyone who's paying for the project, right? You're going to go in front of the users, potentially. So anyone who wants to feedback, like who literally gets to say what constitutes good product versus bad. Let's say you're going to show them a new feature in your software where you can, you know, open a document and print it. That's the thing you worked on in the past 2 weeks. Demo is where you show it to them. So if you put the cancel button in the wrong place, or there isn't a cancel button, someone's going to be upset with you. If it doesn't work the way that they thought it would, they're going to be upset with you. Even if they're the ones who didn't tell you how they wanted it to work, they're still going to be upset with you. So it's high pressure. So imagine you're speaking for the team in this particular round. You're not the leader. It's your turn to run the demo. How would you use visualization to increase your confidence, your success, and get the outcome you really wanted?
So I would create a script.
Okay.
And go through that. So a lot of details as to what you want to include in any visualization script. So what am I seeing? What am I hearing? What am I smelling? What am I tasting? And what am I feeling?
So you're running through it like with all of your senses engaged. You're
absolutely
imagining what it's like to be there.
Absolutely. You want it to be as real as possible, even if it's going to be uncomfortable. You want to feel that. You literally want to smell the coffee in the office. You literally want to feel feel the chalk on the chalkboard or the whiteboard or whatever it's going to be. So you want to make it as real as possible. And then, you know, you'll have some other things. What's the room going to look like? What's the environment? Is it nighttime? Is it daytime? Is it hot? Is it cold? All those details as well. How many people are going to be there? Do you know who they are?
Wow.
Where are you going to be at the front of the room, at the back of the room? Truth be told, I did a visualization exercise for the workshop the other day. And that's why I asked you a few of those questions about the logistics and stuff. So that's the level of detail. And then when you go through it, you obviously want a place with really limited distractions. So you want to turn your phone off or put on airplane mode. You want to be in a comfortable position, whether that's laying down, sitting with your head on the desk, whatever it may be. Maybe you have some like low calming music, or maybe it's just totally silent. And you literally go through the demo with what you're going to say, any potential questions that may arise, and you want to see yourself doing really well. Not to an unrealistic extent, but just you want to see yourself and hear yourself performing really well and delivering it and being concise and being really well-spoken and answering questions on the fly and understanding what they may ask. And then maybe some hardballs as to some, or curveballs, I should say, and how are you going to handle that adversity? Maybe something doesn't work. Maybe the PowerPoint doesn't work. Okay. How's that going to be handled? So some curveballs are always fine, but primarily you really want to have a really pleasant kind of high confidence engagement,
right,
or visualization exercise, I should say. And that's how I would do it, either the night before or a couple nights before.
Right.
And then when you get to the, so that's kind of a mental rehearsal. And then when you get to the actual boardroom, you already know how you're going to react. You already know it. You're on autopilot.
Right, right. So you raised something interesting there, which is that failure is imminent, but you never said overplan for failure. Like a lot of people, when they rehearse things, they want every scenario planned out ahead of time. And this is why Agile exists in the first place, is that traditionally delivery of product involves a massive upfront planning cycle in which we document every potential outcome, every potential need. And then we get people to sign off on that so that we're certain that we know who made the call to go this way versus that way. In case something goes wrong, we got the name of the guy or the girl who sunk the boat. In your visualization steps that you just mentioned, you said plan for failure, but not over plan for failure. That's really interesting.
So as I mentioned before, humans are really good at catastrophizing and seeing themselves fail. And then it turns out like people can literally close their eyes and see themselves, you know, sweating in front of everybody and really not doing well. And it's a snowball effect, and it increases stress and increases fear and increases anxiety and all those things. So we really want to have as much control as we can. And the level of detail will help with that. So who's going to be there? The five senses, all those things, the environment. That's really going to be helpful. And the more you do it, the more skilled you become, obviously, and the more comfortable you become and the more control you have of your visualization, what you're imaging. However, things may come up like those curveballs that you should be prepared for. I wouldn't say plan for catastrophe or plan for failure or stress. However, things are probably going to come up that may be unexpected. So can you lean on your existing knowledge base? Can you lean on your experience? Can you lean on your professional expertise to handle those things? And your if someone asks you a question you didn't prepare for, do you have the creativity and are you able to access information in your knowledge base to answer that question accurately? You might not know what the question is going to be, but you can anticipate someone asking one that you didn't really know about, and then make connections or whatever it may be and answer it in an effective way.
Right, right. So if rehearsal and practice is cornerstone to success, where actual practice is not possible or not possible yet, mental rehearsal, visualization is a huge component of getting that training in. Let's talk about trust for a minute. Here's the second tactical thing you can drop for the team, which is you're sitting in front of a brand new team. Nobody really knows each other, but we know that trust is essential. What are some things you can do immediately that help build trust and engagement and camaraderie? Well, trust really is the big word between the members of the team when you're brand new.
So I think having open-ended questions and open-ended conversations as to, personal questions, but not invasive. So what do you want to get out of this experience? Let's talk about that. Let's be open and honest and borderline vulnerable. And what do you want to get out of here? Okay, for you to get that experience, what do you need from me? And what do you need from him and her and us? So that's, now it's all on the table. Not only, what outcomes do we want to get or business outcomes, not that. What do you want to get at personally? What do you want to get out of this experience? Is it learn how to do a new skill? Is it be part of a team I haven't been part of before? Is it to gain, professional expertise in this area that I haven't?
Right.
So what do you want to get out of this? So again, there's some sharing going on. It's not invasive. It's not overly personal.
Yeah.
But it's that level of, okay, it's kind of safe to share here. There's this underlying assumption that we can share. That's it. One thing that I've done with many teams I've worked with, which I love, is a confidence letter. So you take 10 or 15 minutes in silence and you say, "Dear Chris, congratulations on dot, dot, dot." So, and you write it out, whatever it's going to be, professional, personal, athletic, academic.
Letter to yourself.
To yourself.
Got it.
Whatever it's going to be. And then you keep that. And then I always ask for volunteers to stand up and read in front of the room. And it's really vulnerable and it's really difficult for most people. But I guarantee you the team will be closer once it happens. And the kids who or kids or students or employees who do stand up and read it, not one of them has ever regretted it.
Interesting. I love it.
Yeah. And then they keep the letter and it's a confidence piece moving forward, because when things are down, when you're not, you know, feeling success in what you're doing, you're job hunting, it's not going well, you got cut, whatever it may be, you can pull out that letter and remember some things that you're pretty proud of. It's a bit of an awkward experience because we don't really go through life again thinking, well, what am I really proud of today? And, or what did I accomplish in the last year that I'm proud of? We don't think about that, but it's really healthy to have a little personal highlight reel in our back pocket once in a while to say, you know what, things aren't going so well right now, maybe, but I've been through tough times before and look what I was able to accomplish. Look how I grew. Look how, you know, I added these skills to my repertoire.
And there's something so powerful about putting your future me out there somehow. The Jim Carrey $1 million check example is very similar, that it's like, I'm getting here one way or the other. So I'm going to commit lines in the sand and say, you know, by this date, I'm pretty much going to be here. Putting that out there in the universe actually changes things. It directionally changes things.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And I think having that idea again of removing permanence and removing any permanence to assessment, to test, to interviews, to pitches, to whatever it is, you're going to grow if you have this framework and this perspective that these are all stepping stones and I need this. Not only is it helpful, I need it to grow. You know, failure is not an option. It's a biological requirement is one of my favorite lines from this book called The Talent Code, which I love.
I know that book.
Yeah. But that's basically the thesis of the book. Failure is not an option, or struggle is not an option. It's a biological requirement.
Absolutely.
For growth. So, this idea that, you know, where we are is where we're going to be is really self-limiting.
Right.
And it doesn't need to be there at all.
Well, Matt, there's so many parallels between what you do and what I do. And I use a coach. I have a personal coach. I believe that it's essential to have someone who inspires you, drives you, gives you outside perspective and feedback. If you're not doing those things, I feel like you're missing out. And so what you do is so crucial, so essential to team success, that I want to see this become more and more part of not only an agile culture, but a business culture in general. So thank you for being here. Listen, you guys, you have a team.
Yeah.
And you provide coaching and services to the sports world and to the business world. And I understand some of those services are even online capable.
Yeah.
So tell us about where we can find you, more about what you do and how we can engage you.
Sure. So consistenteliteperformance.com is the website. You can reach me at matt@consistenteliteperformance.com. So there's online things that we're working with now, online delivery. There's telecommunication. A lot of our clients are in the GTA, but some we've had, you know, all over in Montreal and things like that. So it's over Skype, it's over the phone,
right on.
Whatever it may be. And that's where you can find us.
That's fantastic. So guys out there, you got to introduce your teams to the concept of performance coaching and elite performance training. So please reach out to Matt@consistenteliteperformance.com to find out more. Matt, thank you so much for being on the show. It's great to have you here today.
Thanks for having me,
Take
Chris.
Care.